So it's our third night of rambling, and I'm not going to attempt to recapitulate what we've done over the last two nights, but I'll try and start us at a point that doesn't imply too much. I started in the first talk referring to a very important meeting between the Buddha and another wanderer, a wanderer from a different sect called Vachagotta. And Vachagotta puts a number of questions to the Buddha. And one of those questions is, does a Buddha exist after death or not, or both, or neither? Just to make it a little more complicated. We can probably, to all intents and purposes, say either he did or he didn't. And what we saw was that the Buddha, if I said refused to answer any of those, it would suggest that he had an answer and wouldn't give it. That's not the case. What he essentially said was that none of those alternatives met the case. If you thought that the Buddha existed after death, you would be wrong. If you thought that the Buddha didn't exist after death, you would be wrong. And so on. Because in every case, you'd be accepting the assumptions of the question and then, as it were, skewering yourself upon the horns of the dilemma that then followed. So we spent some time, as it were, deconstructing language itself, what language itself is and how it works, and how it leads to abstractions that offer us what seem to be ways of thinking and seeing things that actually just are delusive. They've come from experience, abstracted from experience, then have erected abstractions upon abstractions, and by that time we're lost. So that, of course, still leaves us with a problem of working out what it is that the Buddha experiences, what happens to the Buddha after death. And really, we have to accept that we cannot think about it. We've got no way of thinking about what happens to the Buddha after death, because we can only think about it in the terms that derive from our own sense-based experience within what I've called the world of appearances. We can only think about what happens to the Buddha in those terms. That's existence and non-existence are derived from our experience within time and space. Something's here and then it's not there. It existed, then it didn't exist. So we then try to apply that to something that really goes completely beyond the whole structure of our experience. And we allowed ourselves to name that the unconditioned. The Buddha's existence, if you can call it that. No, we can't call it that. After death, the Buddha is unconditioned. Of course, we must be careful with the predicative use of is and not think it's an existential use for the philosophers amongst you. Language demands that we use is, but is doesn't imply existence in the sense that the cat is on the mat, if you see what I mean. So we filled that space that's left by the Buddha's death with the term unconditioned. And of course, unconditioned is in contrast to our everyday experience. Our experience within the world of appearance is an experience of conditioned arising. Things arising dependent on conditions. When those conditions cease, ceasing to exist. When those conditions cease, something else arises. That's the world within which we operate. The world of appearance, the world that our minds, so to speak, create, and it is in a sense a creative activity, the world that our minds imagine, because it is an imaginative function, from the data of our senses, we construct an image within our our minds. Oh dear, it's so difficult to get this right, isn't it? It's not really within our minds, because our minds also are part of what we imagine. And all of that, what arises dependently, what we appears to us, is constitutes conditioned reality, conditioned existence. The Buddha gives that up. What drives conditioned existence, we saw last night, is desire, is craving, is attachment to a really existent self in here, having experience, and a really existent world out there that is had in experience. But both of those are merely constructions, imaginative constructions that enable the organism to survive from a certain point of view. They have no real independent existence. The Buddha gives up that clinging. He no longer attaches himself to, he no longer is fooled by the appearance of an inner self and the appearance of an outer world. He knows those are simply metaphorical constructions. He knows they have no independent existence. And he gives up craving within them. He gives up clinging to them. He gives up mental craving, that the because belief is a form of craving, is a form of attachment. He lets go of it. And he lets go of the world of appearance. So it ceases to reproduce itself. The flow of conditions stops. Once his body runs out of the conditions, independence upon which it arises, he dies. When he dies, there's none of the momentum, none of the force that can regenerate a new existence within appearance. This is classic Buddhist teaching. Because, of course, according to classic Buddhist teaching, when we die, if we haven't given up craving for appearances, they arise again. We live again. But if we give up that attachment to appearances, and especially the appearance of an identity within, and a field, a world without, then, well, there's no force to bring us to rebirth. So we move from the conditioned to the unconditioned, move in the metaphorical sense. So whenever you make a distinction of this kind, and it's important to make one, for reasons that we looked at yesterday, it presents a problem. We must think in terms of a something that the Buddha moves to when he dies, because if we don't think of a something, we think of a nothing. And although to think of a something is also wrong, it's worse to think of a nothing. Because if we think that when the Buddha dies, there's nothing, what we then think is that this world of appearance is it. Yeah, it's it. This is appearancism in my coinage. You might say materialism, but I think appearancism hits the nail on the head a bit better. I would, because I thought of it. We think that what appears is reality, and that there's no reality beyond it, that this is the sum total of reality. That's what happens if we think that when the Buddha dies, it's the end. We just think appearances stop, the projector is turned off and the lights go out. Do you want to make yourself comfortable? You'll need to be comfortable because I'm going to talk. We need to think of something that lies beyond appearance. Of course, notice my metaphors. I'm using the word beyond. And of course, as soon as we think of beyond, we think over there. You know, beyond the windows at the back, there's the road. So immediately make a sort of spatial a picture, in a way. We think beyond the conditioned is the unconditioned. Of course, this is just a metaphor, but what else are we going to do? I've got to fill an hour with talking. So if I don't have something to talk about, if I don't use metaphors, I can't go into this. So I'm just warning you, here be dragons. We're stepping into territory that is, in a sense, philosophically and therefore spiritually extremely dangerous. And, you know, tiptoe as you go through here, because angels certainly fear to tread here. What does that make us? Oh, yes. It's really important to put some sort of positive content to what happens to the Buddha after death. Otherwise, we put a negative content to it, and that is much more detrimental. But what we do when we put a positive content there, but we hedge it about with all the sorts of caveats and footnotes and conditions that I've been trying to do. We try to make it clear that there is something there, but not in the way that we usually understand something to be there. I hope you're all sufficiently confused. So we make a distinction between the unconditioned and the conditioned. We, as it were, our experience is bounded ordinarily by conditioned arising. We experience appearances. We are an appearance that is conditioned, and we identify with that. And beyond that is the world that the Buddha, especially after his death, experiences and, so to speak, dwells within. So to speak, experiences and, so to speak, dwells within. So we make that distinction. But as we all know, as soon as you make distinctions in thought, you have a problem. The problem is, how do you relate them to each other? And already one or two people have asked me, well, how do you get from the conditioned to the unconditioned? What's the relationship between the conditioned and the unconditioned? The distinction to begin with is, as it were, a spatial one. You think of a place called the conditioned, with a nameplate over the door, and then you think of another place called the unconditioned with a nameplate over the door. Of course, you know that they're really quite different, and so on and so forth. But you cannot but think, how do you get from one to the other? So I'm going to look at three different ways in which we can think about how we resolve this distinction in thought, this necessary distinction in thought, and thereby gain some orientation for our lives, so that we can live out a Dhamma life. Because if you prematurely fail to make that distinction, you either fall into nihilism, you fall into thinking appearance is all there is, or you fall into that terrible alternative, which is what you might call sentimental Buddhism, where you think, oh, you know, there's no distinction between the conditioned and the unconditioned. The conditioned is the unconditioned, and the unconditioned is the condition. So everything I do is unconditioned, which is just really sort of self-delusion. Very common, unfortunately, in Western Buddhism, because we know more than we ought to know, if you see what I mean. We read high expressions of the Buddha Dhamma, and then we apply them within our own rather kindergarten level of Dhamma practice. So the spatial distinction needs to be resolved. We need to hold the idea of an unconditioned, but we need to see how we, so to speak, to use the spatial metaphor, move from the one to the other. So I'm going to offer you three ways of thinking, which really determine three different aspects of practice, and which you, I think, if you can understand what I'm getting at, you'll find do play themselves out in the ways we think and talk about Dhamma practice. So let's continue first the spatial metaphor. We've got the unconditioned, and we've got the conditioned. So the first method for resolving the difference is really to think of the conditioned as contained within the unconditioned. Yes? So we think of the unconditioned as a vast space, maybe an infinite space, and within that infinite space is a conditioned. You know, we're dealing in metaphors which are inevitably simplistic and inevitably derive ultimately from our everyday experience. We have no other choice. Language, thought are derived from our ordinary sensory experience. We have no choice. But what we're trying to do is to, as it were, trick our thought into transcending itself. So we think of the conditioned as contained within the unconditioned. Well, that then means that if we examine the conditioned closely enough, we begin to see the unconditioned. So classically, this would be put in terms of four lines of inquiry, which probably most of you will recognise as present at least in some phases of practice here at the London Buddhist Centre. You, for instance, you begin with an inquiry into impermanence. You begin with an inquiry into the fact that conditioned existence is inevitably, necessarily, impermanent. That one appearance gives way to another appearance, gives way to another appearance. That every facet of appearance is moving, is changing, is shifting. It comes into existence, so to speak, and passes out of existence. Although when we start to examine it even more closely, we notice that there's no point at which it has come into existence and then passes out of existence. So when we say it comes into existence, we have a sort of sense of a balance point where it's done the coming and hasn't started the going. But actually to come is to go. And to go is to come, if you see what I mean. As soon as something starts to appear, it starts to disappear. Its appearing is its disappearing. And of course, its disappearing is the appearing of something else. So we use this observable feature of our appearancing, our experience within appearances. And don't forget, our experience within appearances includes the appearance of a I that is experiencing the appearance, if you see what I mean. I'm part of the appearance. So you take the fact that things come into existence, they end. Talk begins, it ends. After the end of the talk, a class begins, a class ends. Oh, you know what I mean. Just thinking about our dear friends who've left us. I'm remembering this fire station, when it was a fire station. Remembering this shrine hall when it was an engine shed, and there was a pit for the mechanics to look at the underside of the fire engine, just about where you're sitting over there. But don't worry, we've put concrete on it, so you won't go through. And it's where we brought the Rupa up. So no, it wasn't. That was in the reception room, but. You know, my mind has been going back to when this was just an engine shed. I remember seeing it, the blackened walls from the fires. But, you know, through a lot of work by a lot of people, it's been made into a shrine room. It's come into existence. And, of course, one day, it's going to go. Hopefully, not for some time, but inevitably, at some time, it will go. I've seen the great Buddhist sites in India, which are just a pile of stones. One day this will be a pile of stones. some future archaeologists will discover. Everything's like that. I needn't labour the point. In fact, I've probably done so already. if we begin to reflect on impermanence, on impermanent things, not just on impermanence as an abstract idea, but noticing things coming and going, we begin to break down the interpretive framework that we impose upon our experience that gives to them a solidity, an independence, an existence that they just don't have. We begin to see things flowing, you could say. We begin to see that it's not so easy to say where the boundaries lie between one thing and another. It's more difficult to say it's this and not that, because the boundary is simply a boundary in thought. It doesn't exist in the appearance itself. So as we inquire into the flow of appearances from the point of view of their impermanence, we dissolve their distinctness. It's like watching clouds. I live in Wales, so this is one of my favourite pastimes, apart from watching sheep. We have a lot of clouds and a lot of sheep. Sheep are impermanent, regrettably, but the clouds are even more so. And you see them sometimes just boiling over the mountains and forming shapes. And, you know, your mind naturally seizes upon those shapes and tries to interpret them. But the cloud defies your interpretation. You can put the very bland interpretation of cloud, but that's so abstract, it just doesn't do justice to what's happening up there in the sky as the shapes boil and twist, and even you can sometimes see them just dissolving, get the mist rising up from the valley and just completely enveloping us, and then just dissolving into clouds above, and then the clouds gradually burn away. But at no point can you stop it and say, that thing. Everything's like that, actually. It's all a cloud. It's all water. It's shifting and changing without boundaries. So when we look at impermanence deeply, what we see is that it's... what we see is the formlessness of things, the ungraspability of things, the lack of distinct identity to things. Identity is mind-imposed. It doesn't exist in things, it exists in our interpretation. Very usefully for breakfast and things like that, but it doesn't do justice to reality itself. So as you look at the conditioned which arises dependently, which therefore implies a distinction between what conditions and what arises, it just breaks down. There isn't any solidity, any fixity. In Sanskrit and Pali, this is known as the animita. Nimitta is a sign or a mark, something that you can grasp, that you can identify. You say, it's that. But when you view things from the point of view of impermanence, you just can't do that. It just all begins to break down, and it just doesn't have the same identifiable features. So you enter what's called the vimoksha mukha. Mukha means gateway or doorway. Vimoksha means a liberation. So you enter the doorway of liberation, which is animita, without signs, without marks, without characteristics. And this is an exercise you can quite practically engage in. You can look at your experience and recognize that it's impermanent. Then you can examine that impermanence itself. Not theoretically, although you need some sort of theoretical orientation to it. But when you examine closely, you just see there's no boundaries. There's no form fixed at any point. It's like the clouds weaving and shifting and changing. So you move then from the conditioned through the conditioned, you find the unconditioned. You could say that you find that the When you look closely at the conditioned, you notice that it's contained within the field of unconditioned. Or you could say that you notice that within the conditioned is the unconditioned. But those are both metaphors. They have their values and they have their dangers. Every metaphor, I say, has a back and a front. The back points you in the direction it wants you to go, the front points you in the direction you want to go, and the back literalizes it and leads you into trouble. So that's the first of the methods of undermining seeing the unconditioned in the conditioned, or seeing that the unconditioned contains the conditioned. You can see where we're going. Those of you who know your Buddhist thought will see where we're going. And you look at the fact that there's no fixed identity discoverable in reality. There's no I. When I look at my own inner experience, looking for who owns that experience, I can't find the fellow. It's just not there. I can look as hard as I like, but all I find is a congeries of processes, physical processes, emotional processes which change minute by minute, mental processes, thoughts that come and go with lightning-like rapidity, desires that surface and disappear, and that even if, as it were, the same desire appears, it's never the same desire because it's always differently contextualized. Even consciousness itself is flickering and expanding, contracting, changing color, changing shape, metaphorically speaking. There's nothing fixed in there. And the same, there's nothing fixed out there. So when we look at the fact that the conditioned lacks any identity, internally or externally, we arrive at the experience that is known as shunyata. Shunya is the Sanskrit word and Hindi Pali word, which is still used in Indian languages for nothing. Shunya is the Hindi Marathi word, Gujarati word for naught. So you give your telephone numbers, shunya, shunya, ek, no, which always blows me away as a Buddhist. But of course it doesn't sound like that if you're using those languages. But it's used in Buddhism, shunya is used to indicate this experience of lack of identity. The fact that there is no fixed identity discoverable within the conditioned. And that recognition that there is no fixed identity discoverable within the conditioned is itself an experience of the unconditioned. When you experience the shunya nature, shunyata, shunya, emptiness, ta is a suffix that's simply it's the same as ness or iti. When you experience emptiness in this sense, you're experiencing the unconditioned. You're experiencing the fact that the conditioned world is contained within a framework, so to speak, of unconditioned. It is really itself unconditioned. It's just a construction that we put upon the unconditioned that gives us the illusion that it is conditioned. And this experience of shunyata is one that you can have some glimpse of. If you investigate closely any phenomenon, whether internal or external, you'll come to a point where you recognize there's no discoverable independent identity. So moving on, there's the characteristic of conditioned existence that it cannot provide abiding satisfaction. It is in the traditional term dukkha. Dukkha is said to, yeah, it's probably a false etymology, but it's rather a good one. It's said to come from the conjunction of du, which is a suffix that means bad, wrong, and so forth, and ka, which is a root meaning wheel. So it's dukkha is said to be like an ill-fitting wheel. You imagine you're in a car which has got a flat tire, and as you go along, you can feel it going bunk bunk like that, and that's what life is like actually. It does sort of move along. So often, you know, because you're so interested in where you're going, you don't notice that the wheel doesn't fit. But if you pay any attention, and sooner or later you will, you'll notice that actually it's a bumpy ride. And of course, this is just a metaphor. So we want to recognise there's something rather larger than just the wheel doesn't fit. It's the fact that whatever the circumstance, whatever the condition, whatever the assemblage of conditions, there's always a bum note. One, but somebody somewhere is singing out of tune. Somebody's not got the rhythm of things. One of the colours is just not right. And so on. Something doesn't add up. Yes, it's a very neat way of thinking, but we know it doesn't quite fit. Especially, of course, we know that in relation to desire. However beautiful she or he is, they're never perfect. we never discover within the condition anything that completely fulfills, completely satisfies. And if we really sort of take that on board, it leads us into the gateway to liberation, the Vimoksha Mukha, that is called the Apranihita. Apranihita is translated usually as something like directionless. The way I think of this is that, I forgot what I was going to say. Anyway, never mind, I'll come back to it. But the directionless means really desireless. You don't really want anything. You're completely satisfied. Because you're not thinking, I've got it. Because you're not thinking in terms of space and time as real and independent and existing on their own side from themselves. You're not thinking of the conditioned world that you assemble as having any ultimate reality. Well, there's no direction, if you see what I mean. There's nowhere to go. There's nothing to have. Everything is already there. So the directionless samadhi, the directionless vimoksha mukha, the experience of the unconditioned that's approached from this point of view, is of being complete, having everything already, not needing anything, everything within, so to speak. There's nothing driving you outwards in desire. And desire, of course, means pain, one way or another, sooner or later, basic Buddhist teaching. So these are the modes by which we explore our appearance-based experience. We explore it as impermanent. We look deeply into its impermanence. We search into its impermanence, both in terms of reflection, and reflecting deeply upon it, even putting it to the test, asking ourselves, is it really impermanent? Is there anything anywhere that is static, that is permanent? Looking at those things that we get hung up on and discovering them as impermanent. When we do that with sufficient sort of force and intensity, it pushes us through to a quite different kind of experience. An experience that is, to a greater or lesser extent, unconditioned. Again, we look at the fact that there is no identity. You know, everyone's always concerned about their identity these days. We're getting more and more complex in our delineation of identity. But in the end, identity is simply a construction. And if we look closely at identity, whether it's social identity, national identity, gender identity, or whatever, they're constructed. When we look at the world around us and see the identity of objects, they're just constructed, mentally constructed. They have no independent reality. And when we really see that, when we investigate deeply, and sometimes we investigate with great systematic precision even, we inquire into what constitutes my me, so to speak, with laser-like precision, looking at the body, recognizing there's nothing in the body that's static, looking at the mind, recognizing there's in the mind there's nothing that's static, then recognizing there's nothing else. And if you can do that with sufficient sort of force and intensity and uncompromisingly, you break through into an experience of shunyata, which is a joyous experience of the openness of things, in which there's no need for identity. Identity is constructed, unreal, and unnecessary. And again, when you examine conditioned existence from the point of view of its unsatisfactoriness, both in its immediate sense and its deepest sense, if you meditate upon that, if you reflect upon that, if you put it to the question, you interrogate it with sufficient force and intensity and a confidence, you break through into desirelessness, the experience of complete peace, satisfaction, being nobody, going nowhere, not wanting anything, not needing anything, just completely at peace. There's another one could add, which I think is very important, which is if you inquire into the sense of the unattractiveness that's always present, even within the most attractive phenomenon. If you inquire into your own experience of aesthetic experience within the conditioned world, if you inquire into that aesthetic experience, even those things that you find deeply attractive, aesthetically speaking, you'll find there's a sort of question, a sense of limitation, a sense of something not quite complete. And I think the greatest aesthetic experience sort of has a natural tendency to throw you beyond itself, if you see what I mean. When you examine that painting and you see its aesthetic quality, if its aesthetic quality and presumably the sensibility of the artist is sufficiently great, it sort of throws you beyond the painting itself into an experience that in a sense is beauty itself. So you sometimes get that gallery experience of being caught by a painting and pulled through the painting, and then everything around you, when you look away from the painting and walk through the rest of the gallery, everything is revealed by the state that you've been drawn into by that particular painting. It can be almost surprising sometimes. It's the same with poetry, with music and so forth. They have a tremendous power to pull you into the world of beauty, and then to push you, so to speak, beyond the merely conditioned presentation into an experience of something that's more, as it were, unconditioned, at least to some extent. And the Buddha himself very clearly recognized this, that that within the conditioned there is beauty. But whatever beauty there is, and beauty perhaps we should think of more as aesthetic, because beauty doesn't sum up the aesthetic. But within the aesthetic, there is always something that is transcendental, as it were, something that transcends the beauty that is related to the particular sensory assemblage that has called it forth. So we can look at the relationship between the conditioned and the unconditioned in this way, by looking at it as present within the conditioned, the unconditioned as present within the conditioned. But there are two more ways that I want to talk about, and I've not left myself much time, but perhaps that's not a bad thing. I can go right to the heart of the matter. So what I've been talking about so far is, as it were, a spatial relationship between the conditioned and the unconditioned. Because if we're to examine relationships, we have to look at them under either the heading of space or of time. Do you see what I mean? All our experience is bounded by space and time, and all relationships have to either be spatial or temporal. This requires quite a bit of exposition, but I hope you'll at least take it away and think about it. We look at things from a spatial analytic point of view. That's what we did. We analysed the conditioned, and we saw within it, spatial metaphor, the unconditioned. But we can also relate the conditioned and the unconditioned temporally, if you like, dynamically. We can relate them as connected to each other in time. And probably this is the most helpful thing that we can know, particularly in the early stages of our Dhamma life, which is certainly where we are. We can relate them as belonging, so to speak, to a single sequence. So we can think that we have a certain experience now. If we bring certain conditions into existence, a new experience will arise, which is, so to speak, at a higher level, that is, so to speak, closer to the unconditioned, to resort to the spatial again. So that we can think that there are a set of steps and stages within the conditioned. There are some conditions that give rise to further conditions, that give rise to further conditions, that eventually give rise to the realization of the unconditioned. That's what we see in the life of the Buddha. Yeah, you see that the Buddha, through his own lifetime, and we're told through previous lifetimes, performed certain practices, oriented himself in a certain direction, performed certain actions. And on the basis of those actions, which were within the world of the conditioned, where he was still, as it were, taking seriously the idea of an independent self and an independent other, he performed actions that brought about a new experience that was, in some sense, closer to the unconditioned, in which the unconditioned gradually began to shine through, to mix our two methods, if you see what I mean. So that the conditioned, we can use the conditioned, taking the terms of the conditioned, accepting I as a centre of action, accepting a world as a field of action, and we can act in a karmically skillful way. We can perform actions that are skillful. I hope everybody has at least some grasp of what we mean by skillful. That is based on to some degree, on connection, on love, if you like, on friendliness. That is based on non-attachment, on openness, on connection in the form of giving away, giving up. And what comes next? Anyway, that'll do. You can follow through the precepts and so on. So we act skillfully. And through that skillful action, we make the conditions within which with which we are identified, and we identify as real, more and more susceptible to the realization of the unconditioned. Do you see what I mean? It's extremely important to get clear, because it's the basis for our practice within the Dhamma. It's the basis for meditating, the basis for studying, the basis for doing puja, and so forth. That's what makes it possible, because there is a sequence of steps we can take. Otherwise, we're left in the horrible position of knowing that we're conditioned, that there is an unconditioned, but what to do? How to get there? How to make what in Zen Buddhism is called the great sideways leap? But it's very, very difficult to make the great sideways leap until you've created the conditions for it. So a lot of our practice, our early practice, that is for the first few lifetimes, is to do with creating those conditions so that we become more and more able to see the conditioned as the unconditioned. So that's our second method, if you like, and probably in a certain sense the most important of our ways of relating the conditioned to the unconditioned. I think if you haven't grasped anything else from what I've said, this is the most important thing, that the conditioned and the unconditioned are related through the next skillful thing that you do, if you see what I mean. The next skillful action you perform takes you closer to the unconditioned. But there's another side to it that I want to conclude by mentioning, because I think it prevents us from thinking of that process of moving from the conditioned to the unconditioned as a rather sort of imperialistic enterprise of selfish sort of force moving yourself up, because that's kind of counterproductive. And this is a bit more mysterious, and I haven't decided how I'm going to say and talk about it. But let me just say that it's to do with the fact that, in a certain sense, it's not that only we move towards the unconditioned. The unconditioned moves towards us. The unconditioned is moving towards us. Most of the time, we're able to shake it off and push it away, because so firm is our belief in the condition that we don't allow the unconditioned to sort of pull us. There's a kind of tug of war going on between the conditioned and the unconditioned, and we are the rope strung between the two. And it's extremely important what I've just said about making those steps towards it, because we are still convinced by the formulation of a self and a world. But it's increasingly important for us to recognise that, in a certain sense, the condition, unconditioned, is moving towards us, or is moving us towards it. It's difficult to do any more than just speak of that metaphorically. I suppose you could say that, from what I said in the first case, that when you look deeply into the conditioned, there is the unconditioned. Well, that tells us that even in the midst of being thoroughly identified with conditioned reality, unconditioned reality is pressing in on us all the time. So, for instance, you get that strange experience of mixed feelings when disaster strikes, when she finally says, "I cannot live with you any longer." Your heart breaks in two. At the same time, there's a little voice inside that goes, "Hooray!" And they're almost exactly balanced. Even when somebody dies, oddly, and one hardly dares admit it, when somebody dies, there's a strange sense of sort of elation. I remember this very clearly from both my parents dying. You know, died old, and you couldn't sort of feel that there was something tragic about it in an immediate sense. But, you know, they're my parents. I loved them. But in both cases, I felt this sort of opening up. Very mysterious. Because in coming to see death in front of you, coming to see a particular dead body, the mind just cannot comprehend. It just cannot comprehend. Death is not an experience that life can know. You can know that sort of formally speaking, this is now a dead body. But you can't comprehend. And somehow or other, it lets a great burst of light through that usually we very quickly shut down. And particularly, we may even feel rather ashamed and embarrassed about it, because you're not supposed to feel elated when your mother dies. But I think if we're honest with ourselves, in almost all situations of catastrophe, when something ends, when something stops, there's a sudden gleam of something beyond that, which you can't put a name to, but which makes your heart strangely sing at the same time as your eyes are weeping. And this can happen in the most curious of situations. A period of my life, I don't know why, but I'd find that I'd be just talking to somebody and suddenly I'd feel ripped out of myself. There's nothing to do with the other person. And it's a bit difficult then to sort of engage in a conversation with them. But all the time, the unconditioned is defying the conditioned. It's as if with enormous labour, we sort of create an artificial structure with, you know, bits of old wood and old tin that we tack onto it, and bits of canvas that we wrap round it. And all the time it's sort of falling apart. And every sort of moment of our experience reveals that it's a ramshackle thing. It's a put-together thing. I mean, of extraordinary sophistication and complexity. You know, think of the complexity of construction that creates atom bombs and iPads and things like that, and that creates our extraordinarily complex society, and that we're sort of assembling out of our experience with an appearance. All the time we're constructing appearance on the basis of our assumption that appearance is reality. And all the time it's bursting apart. All the time it's defying our construction. As fast as we put the tarpaulin over it, it's blown off. As fast as we erect the scaffolding, it falls down. As fast as we tack the patches on it, it dissolves. As fast as we put the sticking plaster on it, anyway, I won't pursue the metaphors. It defies our best efforts. This constant story that we tell ourselves that reconstructs our experience, it just increasingly won't do. So the unconditioned is permanently, all the time, there. It's the way things are. They are animitta. They have no marks. They are shunya. They have no identity. They are apranihita. They have no direction. They are shubha. They are ultimately, supremely satisfying, beautiful. That's the way they are, all the time. And all the time, that is, as it were, pulling us, pressing in on us. And probably for every one of us who's come here, it's that that's pulled us here. Whatever name we give to it, that's that that pulls us here. I know that from my own life, which is now long enough to have a sense of a trajectory and to think back to a young man, you know, stumbling and wandering through life and trying to work out what the hell was going on. And this strange, unnameable pull. And no, not that, not that, not that. And all the things that convention was presenting to me, I just couldn't take. And only when I came across the Dhamma did I feel there was a way forward to that, that I longed for. I couldn't have put a name to it. I think it presses upon all human beings. The sort of sense that you get in the middle of the night, yes, but there has to be something else, there has to be something more, there is something more. usually because of the materialist, appearancist culture which we're surrounded by, which heavily reinforces our investment in appearance, we quickly suppress that feeling, or we view it negatively. We view it as despair. I think a lot of despair, even, dare I say it, depression, is actually sort of a longing for the ideal that has no direction, no shape, no way of unfolding. So it's not just that we have to move towards the unconditioned, and we do. We have to do a lot of work, and probably to begin with, especially we have to work at moving towards it, because we're so embedded in appearance, we're so committed to appearances. But we must never forget that that the unconditioned is pulling us. It is reality. That is reality. The world of appearance is only appearance. It has a relative reality. It does appear, but its reality doesn't go beyond appearance, if you see what I mean. We're being pulled by what goes beyond that, that pulls us to deep satisfaction, that pulls us to deep fulfillment, that pulls us to truth, that pulls us to love, to an ultimate love that includes everything, that unites everything. And our Dhamma life is lived, as it were, using all these three relationships between the conditioned and the unconditioned. Perhaps you could say most basically it's lived trying to bring about the conditions by the effort of will, accepting the metaphor of an independent I, and using that metaphor of an independent I to create the conditions on which we develop further in the direction of the unconditioned. That's extremely important, and please keep coming back to that. Don't abandon that prematurely, as is such a temptation for over-educated Westerners who have a delusion of their own high spiritual intelligence. They're just clever, them. At the same time, work to see within your experience within the conditioned, your experience within appearances, to see glimpses and gleams of the unconditioned by examining the real nature of appearance. This is not a fancy thing. It's not a philosophical thing. It's an experience. If you look at your experience, it is impermanent. You don't have to have a degree in philosophy or anything of that kind. You don't even have to be literate. I have very good friends in India who are not literate, who are extremely wise in these ways. The Buddha himself was probably illiterate, and probably his education would have been a traditional one, as it were, of his particular tribe. But highly intelligent and able to see reality by looking at his experience. Look at appearance and recognize that appearance is just appearance, and that through it, metaphorically speaking, is the unconditioned. And then always be alert for the unconditioned's movement towards you, its pull upon you, its call to you. You know, the famous vocation in the middle of the night, being called to something further, something more. Particularly one feels when one's young, one feels it very strongly, but quickly one becomes embedded in conditioned identity, and it's usually then only when you reach crisis of some kind, whether externally generated or internally generated, that you begin to open up. But feel for that. Believe in it. We need, if you like, to put it this way, to believe in the unconditioned. Of course, we have to know that the unconditioned is merely, in the end, a conceptual construction that points to something that is beyond our appearance-based experience. But we need to believe in it. And I think this terminology of the unconditioned, if we use it judiciously with a certain sensitivity to the the problems within it is useful to us. Of course, the most important thing is that we experience it, so to speak, imaginatively as present in the Buddha, because the Buddha is the representation within our appearance-based experience of what is beyond appearance-based, so to speak, experience. The Buddha as a figure is a conditioned arising, but that conditioned arising represents a reality that is beyond the appearance-based arisings. But it's really vitally important that we acknowledge this pull upon us and allow ourselves to relate to what goes beyond appearance-based pull. It's the only way to real satisfaction, to real fulfilment. So I hope that in these three rambles, I've clarified something of this very interesting issue of the unanswerable questions and what they lead us to. And especially I hope that you've got some idea of what I mean by appearancism, what I mean between by the notion of the conditioned and of the unconditioned, and I hope you've understood what I mean by these three means of bringing the conditioned to the unconditioned. So thank you very much.